Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
Hello and welcome to the Game Theory Podcast. We've got a great show scheduled today. Matt Penny is going to be the guest. We're going to talk about the NBA draft. We're going to talk about a few different things that we've seen in the playoffs and how they connect to the NBA draft that is forthcoming, such as Jamal Murray and Donovan Mitchell's duel, some of the defensive coverages we've seen, and more. But first, the economy is getting back underway, and with it, the world of pro sports is as well. Stay ahead of the curve with the unparalleled tools of two world-class news desks covering developments across finance, economics, technology, and sports. Subscribe to Bloomberg.com, and if you're not already an Athletic subscriber, for a limited time, you're going to receive a complimentary subscription to The Athletic. Go to Bloomberg.com/subscribe to sign up today. Let's get started here with Matt Penny. The legend Matt Penny is in the building. Penny, how you doing, man?
I feel great. Invested a new microphone. I'm out of my closet recording mixtapes, and I'm here with you. It's great.
Oh my God, you have like an office. What are you talking about? I'm fucking sitting here in my bedroom, like using
I'm in a guest bedroom office. Too, using a makeup stand. It's good. It's like the Kanye picture when he's in the studio by himself, and then he's in Ferrari the next one. Like, remember your friends who are grinding with you. So that's us. We're in side bedrooms, just getting it done.
Love it. This is what we need. In this episode of the Game Theory Podcast, as I mentioned in the little intro, we're going to talk a little bit about bubble takeaways. We're going to talk a little bit about the fact that there's no clear number one pick in this draft. We're going to talk about just the bubble in general and how it's like been kind of weird. And, you know, I think that, Penny, you kind of brought up before this, is this real life? Is the bubble real life?
I think it is. I know you don't. You hate it. But I'm enjoying watching the scoring, and I'm not mad when we're having 50 and 40 points traded back and forth by two really good young guards. The numbers are staggering. I saw a Basketball Reference tweet before this that Donovan Mitchell is 10 points away from the most points ever in a first-round series, 10 behind LeBron. And the last three games, Jamal Murray is shooting 64% from the field and 63% from three. So does this transition next year? I don't know, but I am enjoying watching it for now.
So let's talk about the Jamal Murray, Donovan Mitchell off before we get into what will be a pretty draft-heavy episode as well. I love watching it. I think it's great. I think it's an incredible display of shot-making by these two guys. I'm really struggling with these two teams defensively.
I knew really you wanted bad. To say that, yeah.
They're really bad. They're both
right. They're,
really,
I mean, they're
bad.
But when you see the shots these guys are making, though, I mean, coming off the high ball screens, step backs, threes and transitions, like some of it's self-created, I would say, though, too. Now, when they turn the corner and get in the lane and Donovan's like looking around for another defender to step up and he's just Euro-stepping and finishing by himself, like, yeah, I agree with that.
Yeah, I mean, even some of the stuff with Donovan, right? Because Utah consistently plays this, or Jamal, I'm sorry, Utah plays this drop covered scheme, and this is something I wanted to talk about in general, and we'll get to that in a minute. But like, Utah just does the same thing every single time defensively, almost. Like, they're rarely making an adjustment. Like, I do think that at a certain point they have had Rudy come out and play not quite flat, but like a little bit higher in his drop just to like be able to contest Jamal a little bit. But it's a half measure. Like, they're still dropping at the end of the day, and Jamal is just able to come around these ball screens like with his left hand, take a step back and pull up like it's nothing. Like, that's an open shot. And a big thing that I mentioned on the last podcast is that everyone I've talked to down in the bubble has just been like, the shot lines, the sight lines, everything is just absolutely amazing for shooters in this thing. We're set up to have crazy offense because of that. And when you get guys like Donovan Mitchell and Jamal Murray, who are just fucking riding a heater at the end of the day, right? Like, it's, they're never going to stop with these sight lines. Like, they're never going to miss these shots until they break their momentum in a way. And that just hasn't happened. And I think I saw a stat earlier today from ESPN Sports and Information that said that out of the six games where two opposing players have scored the most points in a game, three of them have come with Mitchell and Murray in this series. It's like Jordan and someone else. Like, it, the people are ridiculous that you're seeing here, but like, they've had three games where one of them's gone for 50 and the other one's gone for 40. And I don't mean to take anything away from those guys. They're absolutely incredible, but like, I'm struggling a little bit with the defense, I guess, of it all. Yeah, I'm really struggling with the defense.
I think with the sight lines thing, it's like the antithesis of the Final Four, right? Like, when you go and play in some big stadium and the guys start out flat, they're not used to shooting like that in a sea of people and humanity behind them. Now it's a little different. You have like almost a wall behind the hoop, like you're playing at a good high school gym to an extent. But the reality of does this transition, it does remind me of the old adage that the world is full of practice players. And the reason I say that is every year college basketball, they have these like secret scrimmages before the season starts. So it's like, oh, Florida State played Ohio State, you know, Florida State won 82-76. And that's like kind of what this is to an extent, right? Like, there's nobody in the crowd. Like, obviously you're going to have nerves, but you're just kind of out there playing more freely. And I wonder how much that kind of adds to the mental psyche of guys out there just kind of letting it fly and not really worrying about any backlash.
Yeah, you don't have fans in the arena. Like, you don't have these like ambient noises and sounds. Like, you're basically just rocking in a practice gym, and it's amazing. I love it. Like, I think it's been incredible.
Now you're back. Now you love it. Okay.
It's been incredible from an offensive perspective, and I've enjoyed watching it. Like, I fucking love it, but I'm trying to figure out how much of it is actually like translatable to next year and how much of these guys like really improve. Because based off of this series, both Donovan Mitchell and Jamal Murray are like top 15 players in the league. And yeah, I don't think that's true.
Yeah. And I think it goes beyond those two guys, but they're just at such a higher level right now that they're going to take the headlines. But there's plenty of other guys who've broken out in the bubble and it's like, okay, it's this undrafted guy, the second round guy that got more run, whether it's because of injuries or what have you, are they going to stay consistent the following year too?
Yeah. Is Tim Luwawu Cabarrot going to be a rotation player for the Nets next to KD and Kyrie next year? The bubble would have you believe yes.
Maybe. I mean, they were looking for bodies pretty badly, and it's like the Donovan thing. I mean, we were talking before about draft position, and he had an opportunity there to really leave his mark. They needed scoring from that spot. So it's also guys taking advantage of opportunity they may not normally have.
Yep. So let's talk about Donovan particularly, because there are very few, if any, players across the entirety of the NBA that you have more experience with and that you have more of a background of knowledge that you can share with people than with Donovan, because you've seen Donovan's growth and maturity from the time that he's what, like 16, something like that.
Yeah. I mean, he played on the Under Armour circuit. He went to Brewster Academy up in Wolfboro, New Hampshire, played for Jason Smith. So saw plenty of those games and came to Reebok camp. So he was been around a lot. And like I've said before, Donovan's an unbelievable kid, a great worker, comes from a great family. I thought he'd be good in the NBA, but admittedly, I never, ever saw this. And you look at the draft, too. I mean, in 2017, he ends up going 13th. I know a lot of teams wish they could have that draft back, and guards in front of him included Frank Ntilikina, Dennis Smith Jr., Malik Monk, Luke Kennard, and then you also had toward the top there Fultz, Ball, Tatum, etc. And bam, Adebayo went 14th. But I've always been a huge Donovan fan, but even what he's doing now, I didn't envision him doing this at such a high level consistently.
So yeah, I agree with you. And I wrote a story for Sporting News back in like the year before it was the summer before his sophomore year, the breakout year that he had. And I was at Adidas Nations where he was there, and he played okay at Adidas Nations, but what impressed me and what made me realize that he was going to get the most out of whatever potential he had was, here he is, he's this kid who's from the Northeast, was going to Louisville. He gets a weekend in Southern California. Everyone who gets this weekend in Southern California is like, hey, like, let's get out of here early. Maybe we go to bed so we can get to the beach early. Maybe we go do other things, right? Maybe we're going out and having a good time because we're in LA for maybe the first time in their life in many cases. Donovan Mitchell, like, missed a bunch of open shots. He specifically missed, like, a game winner in these scrimmages to, like, have his team win. Like, it was college kids against college kids, basically, just, like, playing scrimmages that don't matter for anything other than playing in front of NBA scouts. And instead of, like, packing up and going, he grabbed a ball and found, like, an empty hoop and just started shooting. Like, immediately, he started shooting. Getting shots up, and I'm like, who is this first? I realized it was Donovan, like, as I walked up close. And then next, I have a conversation with him, like, hey, Donovan, like, would you mind taking a few minutes? Love to chat with you. And he's like, hey, yeah, just let me finish getting my workout in, right? 45 minutes later, after his workout, so he shot for like an hour after everyone had left the gym, basically, except for me, him, his mom, and I forget if it was a brother or sister. I think you told me earlier it probably would have been a sister. Jordan, yeah. In this gym, just waiting to for him to finish his workout. Eventually he finishes. We talk for like 20 minutes. Elite level kid, like you can tell, just like super high character kid, obviously just donated essentially 90 grand to, I believe, a scholarship fund for Jacob Blake's kids to go to college.
Like, right, with his new shoe launch, yep.
Yeah, incredible, incredible human being. But you could also just tell that like the work ethic was there from day one, that whatever his ceiling was, he was going to reach it. Now, I do think that there are some very substantial and real changes he's made since even that year at Louisville that have made him be as good as he was. Like, he was a 2-foot leaper in high school, in his first year at Louisville, and even in his second year at Louisville, he was mostly a 2-foot leaper as a finisher. He totally changed that and became a 1-foot leaper who could maneuver around guys on the ground and get open angles at the rim to finish. And when you have a 7-foot wingspan, it becomes a lot easier to do that whenever you're also able to angle yourself and create that angle on the ground. So he has made genuine improvements that are difficult even for hard workers to do. But I agree with you. I did not see him becoming top 20 player in the NBA even at all.
Yeah, and there's some things to unpack there too. Athletically, he was a late bloomer. I want to say he has like size 18 shoes or somewhere around there. And he like grew into his body later. Like he started to really show his athletic tools off, I think around like his junior year of high school, where he's really starting to do stuff off the bounce and go through layup lines. He's windmilling his foot through his legs, albeit off 2 feet. And you're like, holy smokes, that is not something that I expected coming out of him. And then also, he wasn't this really revered kid where he was like top 15 in the country. All that happened so late. That was like his junior year heading into his senior year. He was a late add to the Elite 24 game. So like all the basketball fame stuff was relatively new to him. And I think going to Louisville and playing for Coach Pitino, he keeps you pretty grounded while you're there as well. And the last piece is he grew up around the Mets organization. His dad worked for the New York Mets. So yep. I don't think that some trip to LA or a little bit of glitz and glamour really was something that, you know, turned off his work gauge for the weekend. I think he saw that as an opportunity to get better and measure himself against the best. And you could see his confidence really growing that last year at Brewster Academy. I thought he'd be in Louisville at least 3 years. Obviously, I was wrong. And he's carved out an unbelievable role here. And it is just crazy. It's crazy to see, like, he was 44, he's 50. Oh, he had a bad game at 35 every single night in the series. So I think game 7 will be fun and hopefully more drop coverage. They can have 60 each and you can pull your hair out and send some tweets about, you know, I'm having fun.
I'm having fun as I pull my hair out and like meltdown about like, what are these teams doing in terms of strategy? Do you want to talk about Jamal Murray? I don't know what your background is with Jamal, to be honest.
I mean, not as heavy outside of knowing that what he's doing in the bubble is unbelievable, and coming out of Kentucky, same thing. Like, I really liked him, but in that draft you had, I don't know if it was across the board, but a lot of people said it was Ben Simmons, Ingram, and then kind of a drop off, and then it really went Jalen and Bender, Dunn, and Buddy Hield. And the Celtics drafted third, and being from Boston, I kind of looked at that pick and wondered who they were going to get. Thought they'd get some shooting. Thought it might be Buddy Hield. It wasn't. And then Jamal goes there. I thought he'd be fine. I thought he'd be good. But he's like the latest in a longer run of Kentucky guys that have done more than what they really showed at Rupp Arena.
Yeah, there's no question there. He has gotten better as a lead ball handler. Like, when he was there, I didn't really see him as someone who could, like, take over an offense and be, right, like, true point guard. And, like, look, they have Nikola Jokic certainly initiate a lot of their sets, right? Like, he's not the pure point guard there. He is playing a lot more of a scorer role. And that puts a lot less pressure on him to try and improve other aspects of his game. But the way that he's improved his finishing craft, I think, has been remarkable. The way that he uses his body to just kind of angle the ball away from guys and protect it, and then use different angles as a finisher, I think, is really impressive. The way that he's really improved as a pull-up shooter, like that Kentucky scheme, a lot of it for him was coming off of pin downs and, just catching and firing, right? And he averaged 20 points a game.
20 points a game. He shot over, I think, 42% from three or somewhere around there. Like, he was good, but yeah, right. I'm like you. I remember him hitting a three, doing the big bow and arrow thing, the running back on defense. I didn't think he'd be this incredible guy who splits two defenders, does a reverse 360 layup, and finishes with his offhand, you know, in game five or whatever it was.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. It's totally ridiculous that he has turned into this. And it's like kind of made me think, like, what is his, he has made me reassess what I think his ceiling is. Because coming into the series, I think that a lot of folks within the basketball industry on teams and, in the public sphere as well, kind of questioned, is that contract going to end poorly?
Right.
For the Denver Nuggets. He has, I believe, $158 million or something over 5 years. And, is going to be right around what it'll be, like $130 left on that deal for 4 years after this season. So, like, I think that that was where the conversation was, and he's totally changed that now. Is he going to be someone that actually lives up to that contract? If this continues into next season, sure. And look, Jamal was very hit or miss last year in the playoffs. Like, there were games where he was absolutely spectacular and was the absolute key as to why they won the game in the playoffs last year. I believe specifically in the San Antonio series stands out in my brain as one where he kind of had a few games that were awesome and kind of had a few games that were not super awesome necessarily. I'm pulling up the numbers now as we talk, and Basketball Reference is moving very, very slowly, unfortunately. But then he goes and plays Portland, and if I remember correctly, again, like the Portland series, he was just kind of okay and didn't necessarily stand out in the way that we had hoped, maybe is the way to put it. So in the San Antonio series, he goes, in the final four games, he goes 24 points, 23 points, 16 points, 23 points. And then in the Portland series, he has the big 34-point game whenever that game went to like 14 overtimes.
Right.
How many, yep, it was exactly. Then he follows it up with 34 the next game in a big win. But then these last two games, he goes 7 of 16, or last three games, he goes 7 of 16, 7 of 20, 4 of 18, and kind of shoots him out of it. So for him to go as supernova as he did this year makes me think that he kind of learned a lot about where he could improve and how he could make a leap in these playoffs. And he certainly just kind of incorporated everything.
Yeah, and it goes back to your point. Do you think the bubble is real life? Do you think that defense is going to continue to do this and let him play the way he is? I mean, he's also gotten out in transition, created a lot of stuff too, which I think has opened up a lot.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, look, he's playing Dame Lil Woodard and CJ McCollum too. I mean, it's different, right? It's like it's a different brand of attacking guard theory. So maybe it's just a better matchup there. And he's gotten better and taken more responsibility as a lead scorer, creator, and doing a lot.
So let's just talk about the bubble, I guess. Now let's move to that. And my question is right now, why are teams that play drop coverage as their primary defensive scheme in the regular season, why have they been so slow to adjust to trying something else, basically? Like in Portland's case, they couldn't do anything else, right? Portland has Yusuf Nurkic, who was coming off of injury, Hassan Whiteside, who you just straight up can't put in space, and then Zach Collins was injured, right? So they just didn't have a choice. They had to play drop coverage, and the Lakers destroyed them for it, right? But a team like Denver, like Nikola Jokic, they often do play like pretty flat, and they have adjusted some defensive looks here and there throughout the series, but they are giving Donovan a few too many, you know, easy shots that he can just step into coming off the screens. Utah, I don't understand why they don't play a bit flatter with Rudy Gobert. Like, I guess that maybe they're concerned about what has happened in the past against guys like Russell Westbrook and, the Houston Rockets specifically have really put him into space. But, like, I don't know if Denver is necessarily going to do that. Like, I would like to see them play a bit more flat coverage. Milwaukee was fine defensively in that first series. Like, you look at the numbers, like, they have a 101.9 defensive rating, but they were also playing Orlando, who was like a totally terrible offensive team in that series. I just keep like looking at these teams, like the Clippers, like Luka absolutely murdered them when they played drop coverage, and eventually they did try and switch away from drop coverage, and it really helped them get Luka Doncic different looks, and Luka was just not quite as successful. I'm just wondering why these teams aren't as willing to kind of go away. And part of it's probably personnel. Part of it's kind of, you know, this is what you do. But man, I would be hoping to see some adjustments out there, I guess, in a way that we haven't necessarily seen.
Right. And you'd think they'd make adjustments for game seven, maybe throw out the book and say, this isn't working, this is working. But a lot of it has to be personnel, right? It's like, these are your available guys. This is the way we need to play. Guys who stay with it and stay with that similar defensive scheme, and the games are being scored in the 120s, you'd think they'd go back to the drawing board and say, okay, what can we do differently? Can we throw a little bit of zone? Can we switch a little bit more? Do we go small? Do we go big? I mean, we were texting the other day about how Toronto was forced to go big with Siakam in foul trouble, so you had Gasol and Ibaka out there at the same time, and immediately Brad Stevens goes to kind of like an ISO clear out for Tice to gets a quick two. So it really is kind of dependent on what you have for available guys too.
Yeah, for sure. And I guess that where I go with that next is, if I was a team that, you know, had to play drop coverage, like for instance, like Minnesota, I just wrote about Minnesota for today.
20,000 words.
Literally, I think it was nothing.
Yeah, so it was good. It was good.
Too many words. But like, Minnesota has to play a drop coverage scheme as their primary because they have this unbelievable matchup advantage at center in Karl Anthony Towns, who's going to get you 27 and 12 a night in knockdown threes and be arguably the second best offensive center in the league behind Jokic, right? But behind him as a backup, or even as someone that could potentially play next to him, I would want someone who can give me a different defensive look. Like, I would want someone who can be switchable defensively, or at least play like flat coverage defensively, and then you have to like fight over the top of the screen and recover, right? Like, I would just want someone who can give me a different look. And a lot of these teams, they don't really have that.
Yeah, and you know, your piece today, it was funny. I was scrolling. I'm like, who's he going to say for Minnesota to take? And it's a good like kind of transition into more drafty stuff.
Yeah.
And when I saw number one, trade, I'm like, well, that makes sense. But in a draft like this, where there's not necessarily the value at the top as there usually is, and you reach for an Okongwu there, like, you're not taking James Wiseman for reasons we just outlined. LaMelo and Anthony Edwards aren't helping defensively next to D'Angelo Russell. So yeah, that the answer is probably Onyeka, but I don't know. You don't take him first, right?
Yeah, like you try and slide back a couple picks, pick up some extra value, and then you take Onyeka if that's the guy that you want. Part of Minnesota particularly is I think the way that that front office is going to operate is they're just going to operate based off of just wanting guys. Like they want value, they want asset value as much as anything. I think they're going to keep kind of moving and shaking a little bit via trade with this roster up until the start of not the 2020-21 season, but the start of the 2021-22 season. Until they have a core that they think they can compete with around D'Angelo Russell and Karl Anthony Towns. But I guess that where I just keep looking at this, you know, and using another team like Portland, for example, like Portland went out of its way to try and sign Hassan Whiteside, or to try and trade for Hassan Whiteside, because they knew that Nurkic was not going to be totally healthy this year. I would have gone like a totally different direction, assuming I was going to get Nurkic back at some point. Like I would have gone for a mobile center, even someone like Noah Vonleh can at least play like flat coverage and give you something different, I guess is my point. Like I would want something different than what I have if I'm playing.
Yeah, you want a more small ball guy that can switch, that can hold guys on the perimeter a little bit longer, that's not exposed being pulled out there. And
yeah,
that also plays to, okay, James Wiseman and Karl Towns can't play together. The Ibaka and Marc Gasol thing didn't work there and didn't work in crunch time. You can only do it for these small little segments of time, or you're right, you get exposed, especially when you're playing good guards who are averaging 42 points per game each.
Right. Right. No, 100%. So I guess that where I'm going with this is if I was drafting this year, I would want the ability to, at the very least, not have to play drop coverage. Like maybe that is my primary if I have a Karl Towns or someone, but if I was building a roster and I got to build it from scratch, I don't think I would want to build a roster where drop coverage is like my immediate go-to. And like the antithesis of this is obviously the Milwaukee Bucks, right? Like they are the best team in the league defensively this season, and they play primarily drop coverage. But my argument against them would be that they have the defensive player of the year.
Yeah, exactly. Giannis, who I don't know what position he is, and he covers ground and everywhere and has an enormous wingspan. So it's different. It's not like a traditional five like you're talking about. Yeah.
Right. And if you are going to play drop coverage, so many people have looked at the center position as being the most important because you have to have the short area quickness and you have to have the length to be able to kind of play within the gap and be able to contest floaters while also being able to slide backward and use verticality, right? I almost think that Giannis position is more important now after watching that. You have to have the back line that can be a primary weak side rim protector, that if your guy has to play up a little bit, then that guy is always there to clean up the scraps. Like I feel like that's just what you have to do.
Yeah, I mean, if you can get Giannis, you get Giannis, right? But it's like the Celtics game from yesterday, they got really good minutes combined from Tice and Robert Williams.
Right.
And not necessarily traditional-ish centers, but, you know, when you have 15 rebounds and you're able to expose the Raptors going big, I mean, I think that's the way the NBA is certainly trending. And if you can get seven-footers who can move and defend and rebound, obviously you get it, but then you have to work around it. Yeah, are you having Noah Vonleh play center somewhere? I mean, that might be a better option than what guys have done in the past.
Yeah, and like Daniel,
I don't know, I get hooked on Noah Vonleh, but I just mean like his kind of archetype of guy.
Right, and like Daniel Tice, for instance, is like kind of a perfect example of this because he is someone that can play flatter coverage. Like you don't want to like just straight up switch him onto a guard, right? Like he probably will get cooked out there doing that, but you can play a flat coverage with him and then have Marcus Smart, or even like Kemba Walker is good in recovery because he fights at least. Like he's small and doesn't have great length. And, you know, if he's contesting from behind, it's probably not going to work as well. But if Tice can contain off the dribble while Kemba's recovering and then recover backward because Tice has that mobility, like that's a win, I think. Like we've kind of I feel like Daniel Tice has gone kind of underrated throughout.
He did. He was you know, the Celtics, I mean, they have a million centers, but none of them really kind of fit what they were looking to do. And earlier in the season, when Tice would kind of do that dribble handoff fake, guys would just give him, you know, 5-6 feet because he wasn't shooting as well. And now he's hitting threes. So you have to respect what he's doing there. It opens the game up so much more.
Yeah, it absolutely does. What is kind of your takeaway? Do you have another one kind of based off the bubble in terms of how you would think about draft strategy?
Yeah, we've talked about this a little. Is kind of your take on smaller guards and how they fit into the NBA ecosystem? And what I mean by that is I was talking to a friend the other day and he said, okay, think about what Trey Burke and Campaign gave in the bubble, right? I think Trey Burke is on his sixth team and drafted ninth. Mm-hmm. Campaign is on his fifth team, I think, drafted 14th. Played very well, and you kind of pick these guys up deep into free agency. It's like, why don't you roll the dice more with wings in the 30s, 40s when you have those type of guys? You have Fred VanVleet, you have TJ McConnell undrafted. The 6 foot undersized guys, they kind of find their way back to a league where you don't necessarily have bigger guards, wings readily available that can contribute. And when you look at this draft, just as kind of frame the question for you, you have a lot of guys in that mold, and Dotson and Cassius Winston, maybe Nico a little bit, Malachi, Peyton Pritchard. There's a lot of guys that fit in that same category of, all right, is it worth taking a smaller guard at, say, 32 rather than maybe an Elijah Hughes or a McDaniel, somebody like that?
Yeah, you know, that's a really interesting point. And I have been kind of thinking about that a little bit in regard to someone that I really like in Cassius Winston, right? Like, I've been thinking about Cassius Winston in the vein of someone like a Devontae Graham, right? And Devontae Graham is someone that I really liked this year because he makes good decisions with the ball as a passer, but more than that, because he's become an elite level pull-up threat. And Cassius Winston is someone who also makes good decisions as a passer, or let me rephrase, sometimes makes poor decisions as a passer, but is a good passer who sees the second and third level of the defense while also being an elite level pull-up shooter. But someone like Campaign is like that size, you know, like Devontae right. Graham is bigger than Cassius Winston. And Grant Riller is bigger than Cassius Winston.
Yeah, he's so probably 6'3".
Yeah, something like that. So, like, I've been kind of struggling in my brain. And, like, another one that I really like is Malachi Flynn, right? Like, we've talked about
Malachi. You love Malachi Flynn, yeah.
Yeah. And Malachi is small, but Malachi also, like, defends his ass off. Like, to me, if I was drafting a small guard, I would want someone who I know is going to defend and who I know can get his own shot, I think are the two critical skills right now for those guys to have success. Otherwise, it's going to be really hard. Cassius Winston might not be able to get his own shot, unfortunately. Like, he might need a ball screen, and those guys
yeah.
are just like
a lot of pick and rolls. Yeah.
Right. And those guys are just like a little bit inherently less valuable because if you like have to switch that ball screen and you get a wing or a two or someone on him, he probably isn't going to be able to beat that guy. Even if you get like a 4 or 5 on him, he's probably not going to be able to beat that guy.
Right. And Devontae is a good counter to the argument. And I think Jalen Brunson is too, albeit him being injured right now, who coincidentally went back to back in the 2018 draft. But it is interesting to think about just because you're looking in, we'd say maybe not as deep a draft as we've had. I mean, I think there is some value late in the first, early second, but just not necessarily the firepower that we've looked at before. And it just kind of shapes how you want to put your team together. And there's guys that will be there. There's guys that will emerge, whether it's one of those small guards or not, that comes out in the second round. I guess I'm just saying, why not try to do it on a wing and just get one of those guys in either two-way or after the draft or through summer league. I mean, those guys probably will all be drafted, but there'll be others of similar vein who you can get on a kickback, like a Trey Burke campaign.
Yeah, and I think you're right on that. I will not go against Malachi Flynn.
I know Malachi that. You will Flynn not is, take his name in vain. You've made that I very clear. I will not.
But guys like I probably will drop, like, Cassius Winston, Peyton Pritchard's another one that's pretty small. Devon Dotson's pretty small. I probably should, like, move those guys down a little bit, if only because if they can't play in ISO, it becomes a lot more difficult for them to create efficient offense, in my opinion. I think that's a very insightful statement from you.
Yeah, it wasn't. I'm a collector of information that I blast out to the people. I can never take some of these things as my own.
But like Desmond Bain's a guy that I've had pretty high throughout the process. I have Elijah Hughes at like 34. I feel comfortable taking Cassius Winston at like 34. If
right.
I'm,
but like you said, like those two guys are 6'5", 6'6", right? It's like you feel more comfortable taking those guys as opposed to maybe Cassius at that spot.
Yeah, I agree with that. Totally. Like I would rather bet on a wing. Probably a wing that can shoot is maybe the better way to put it.
Yeah, nobody drafts centers or point guards anymore. Everybody's a wing, right?
Yeah, that's a very
good. It's like point. Fred Van Vliet has become the guy now on the grassroots circuit. Like, oh, he's 6 feet, he's underrated. It's Fred Van Vliet. He's like ruined the point guard position, like Kevin Durant's ruined being a 6'10" two guard, as Eric Bossy would like to say. Everybody's 6'10". Oh, he's really a guard. He's just playing out of position. It's like,
Jaden McDaniels is a guard. Like, it's fine. Yeah, no, right. He's closer to being a five than he is to being a guard. Like,
yeah, and that's the ironic thing is you have all these guys who are, the Kevon Looney's of the world, who are 6'7", 6'8", who are, whatever, top five prospects out of high school. They never thought they would have been playing the center, but they do it, and that's their role, and guys make money doing that. But for whatever reason, jacking threes at 6'9" is, I guess, a lot more appealing to the youth. But I'm yelling at cars right now.
Kevon Looney is a good one because Kevon, coming out of Milwaukee, was a legitimately so skilled, like 6'9", 7'4" wingspan, like combo forward, kind of.
Right, but you never thought he was like a small forward.
No,
he's a four, he's a five in the new school NBA. Like, I never saw that kid and said, yeah, we got to get him more ball skills and be a two.
I will say, like, I thought he was probably a playmaking four.
That's fine. Like, yeah.
It just shows how skilled NBA players are. Like, NBA players are so goddamn good that, like, that guy who was a top 10 recruit coming out of high school because he was as skilled as he was with the ball in his hands. That guy's like a dirty work center in the NBA now, who just like does what he has to do to stick in the league and does a great job of it. Like, I don't mean to disparage him in that way, but that's not my point, is that like, it's not a disparagement to say that he's done what it takes to stay in the league and has become like a very, very, very effective role player on title teams.
Yeah, and if you don't adapt to it, you're just out of the league. They'll draft somebody else the next year who will do it.
Right, 100%.
And he's gotten better, and he's embraced what he is. And look, there's guys in draft that aren't going to, and they'll be overseas in a few years. That's just the way of the world.
So you wanted to talk about the fact that there isn't a clear-cut number one in this class. And
yes,
I just kind of want to give you the floor to be able to do that. But first, let's hear from two quick advertisements.
This is the Athletic Football Show.
I think every football season's a big challenge in one way or another.
Introducing the Athletic Football Show, an all-new podcast with me, Robert Mays, and a team of world-class NFL writers and analysts. We'll feature expert guests and our plugged-in beat writers from around the league.
What Patrick Mahomes did in the last 9 minutes is just absurd.
You can subscribe now to the Athletic Football Show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or the podcast provider of your choice. And stay with us all season long as the Athletic brings you what matters most in today's NFL.
Okay, Penny is here still. We're back. And now we're going to talk about his take on kind of the race for the number one prospect and who he thinks is the best prospect, maybe. Like, I don't even know if you want to give us that. But, like, I'm fascinated in just kind of where your stance is on this number one overall player consideration.
Well, I don't know. And the bigger picture is it's been such a weird year for everyone everywhere, but in basketball especially, where you had no Final Four, you had no national champion, you've had the draft pushed back. I mean, I think people forget what day it is. It's August 31st. I mean, the draft would have been over for 2 months by now under normal circumstances. Yep. The salary cap's up in the air.
By the way, like, the draft still might not be happening for 2 months.
Based off
of like current reporting and having talked to, executives around the league, like, I think executives would prefer it doesn't happen for another 2 months.
Yeah. And I'm glad we're staying on it and talking hoops, but like, how many people are really searching for draft stuff right now? Like, I don't know, but there is no clear cut number one. And it's interesting to me because each of these players who are kind of in consideration have a very unique background. Anthony Edwards, a true one and done. James Wiseman, I like to say he's like a high school to pro guy because he played 3 games in college and then he was out. LaMelo is this somewhat international player, played in the United States a little bit at Spire Academy. Denny's an international mystery man. And then you have, I don't think Obi Toppin's necessarily the in contention for number one, but he's the college basketball darling on an unbelievable Dayton team that probably would have made a run deep into March into April. All that being said, I don't know the kind of separation. I think it's different if you're saying who fits in Minnesota versus who the number one overall prospect is. I still am on the LaMelo bandwagon as you are, but there's also not really opportunities for any of these guys to leapfrog one another right now either.
Yeah. And what the NBA does with making choices on can kids like travel to facilities, because right now they cannot. Is there going to be a virtual combine? You talk to 10 different people, you're going to get 7 different answers in terms of the structure of it, in terms of will it happen? Some people think it won't happen. Like, there, and these are like people around the league that like should theoretically know, and it still is just kind of up in the air right now, it seems like, in terms of what that will look like if they choose to make it exist. It's just very difficult. And I think that people ask me all the time, like, how is someone raising their stock? How is someone, moving up and down draft boards? At this point, it really is just like an eye of the beholder situation. Like, you get intel on these kids and like you talk to teams and it's just like, okay, this is what's happening. This is where we think guys are. Like, throughout the process, there have been more cooks in the kitchen also than what I think has ever happened before. Like, if you have a coach that's been around long term, like Steve Kerr, right? Steve Kerr hasn't been able to get involved in the Warriors draft process until like 2 days before the draft every single season, right?
Yeah, no, that's a good point.
Like, Steve Kerr was involved in their draft process now 4 months before the draft happened and has probably intricately watched every single one of these prospects that they would considerably take at number two.
Right. And that one too is like, I think a lot of places right now have said maybe James Wiseman's that guy, and you're on your drop coverage, small center stuff. Does he fit with the Warriors as an old school type of center? I mean, there was Anthony Slater, who's the Golden State Warriors beat writer. I was reading on The Athletic. His quote was, young centers are hard to keep on the floor in the playoffs. The Warriors should make this selection with 2023 in mind. 2023, Steph Curry will be 35 years old. I don't know if you want to go through that experiment for whatever, the foreseeable future. I mean, they'll probably, I'm guessing, try to trade and get a piece and get a veteran too. But yeah, the Steve Kerr thing is interesting, and I don't necessarily know who fits there. Like, if Anthony Edwards applies to two, does he fit with their current schemes and personnel?
So I also wonder how much the Warriors, I think the Warriors are the team most likely to move this pick in the lottery. Like, they're definitely calling around and trying to gauge value and all that stuff. That's not a secret though. Like, that's been reported everywhere.
Right.
Right. I wonder how much they will consider using this pick as a potential down the road trade asset. Like, for instance, in 2021, at the trade deadline, they're going to have that player potentially if they don't move it before the draft, and this Minnesota Timberwolves pick from next year, potentially, that is going to be a top, you know, in my opinion, probably a top seven pick.
Seven, yeah.
Yeah. So that's going to be two really, really good, good young players on cost control salaries, potentially move for a superstar. Like, we don't know what the league's going to look like then. Do the Wizards consider moving Bradley Beal by that point? Do the Bucks, like, does someone get hurt in Milwaukee? Does Chris Middleton, like, tear his ACL or something?
Oh, Jesus.
God hope, like, let's hope that doesn't happen.
Where'd that come from? Yeah.
But, like, if that happens and they can't compete and they feel like Giannis isn't going to re-sign, you probably have to make a consideration there about moving Giannis. And I think that that's a disaster scenario for Milwaukee, and I hope that it doesn't happen. And I think that there's a chance Giannis re-signs this summer, but we don't know that yet, or I guess this offseason, not summer now. But we just don't know yet what any of the league is going to look like at the trade deadline in 2021. So I wonder if the Warriors, if they do end up having to use this pick, do they take the guy that they think is going to have the best long-term trade value, or at least the best trade value in 2021, to potentially pair with something else to go out and acquire another superstar that can play both now with Stephen Curry, Draymond Green, and Klay Thompson, and into the future and be their next superstar?
Yeah, potentially. I mean, I think the only certainty that we know is that there will be trades on draft night. And another thing that someone sent to me is the last 3 years, a team has traded out of the top five. I'd say probably Golden State. You think that they're the one if you're looking at the board right now, but it's going to happen. And
I will throw Minnesota out there as well. Gerson Rosas is not going to consider. He will explore every option. I feel
sure,
very
but like,
confident of that.
Who do you think suitors could be that are just like, we need Anthony Edwards, we need LaMelo Ball, like, we need pick number one?
I mean,
do you think there's anyone out there?
I've brought up the Knicks as like a very real possibility. Okay. Just because if they really want like a true lead guard, this is a good draft to get that. If Charlotte wants to guarantee themselves who they like really want, right? Like, do they want to for sure get their next superstar or potentially their next superstar? Do they try to move up? Does Detroit under Troy Weaver try to make a splash by moving up because they don't really have like any young pieces that are amazing? Like, I'm not saying that any of this is likely. I'm saying that there are teams that you can make a reasonable case for moving up.
Right, and like you said, Pistons, Knicks, Bulls, all new management groups, like those are all very possible. I know after the draft, Troy Weaver kind of said, yeah, I like where we are. I like where we're drafting. I mean, we've had guys in Oklahoma City fall to us in the past. So, I mean, you're at seven, and history showed outside of the top five, like there's good players there. I mean, again, another quote I stole, Mark from the New York Post said 13 of 24 All-Stars this season were drafted eighth or later. So there's guys out there. You have to trust in your scouting department. You have to trust in your own personal research, because as much as people have crushed this draft, and maybe it's bad, maybe it's not as good as it should be, and it's not even close to next year, there's going to be a guy here somewhere.
Yep.
Now, how you find him and how you earmark him, whether it's 13, 30, or first, I don't have those answers. You know, I have no horse in this race, but I still beat my head against the wall trying to figure out why this guy's good and this one isn't, and what signs we missed leading up, whether it's characteristics or whatever. His shooting was lower from three, but his free throw was good and it can improve. I don't think there's an exact science to that answer either.
And speaking of, you know, what did we miss? And, you know, kind of playing Monday morning quarterback, like one thing that you want to talk about was just Luka Doncic.
Oh, yeah.
And the scouting process that went into that. I generally think that, for especially the Kings, just so drastically overthought that situation. Indisputably, they just fucked it up. But you give me your spiel on what you want to talk about with Luka here.
So, I mean, in that draft, he goes, Ayton goes first, Bagley goes second, he goes third, but when you really think about it, he kind of went fourth, seeing Trae Young and him like flopped picks, right?
Right.
So the Suns get the first overall pick. They hire his former coach from the Slovenian national team, Igor Kokoschkov. who is also an assistant coach in the NBA. It's not like, you know, you hired some dad whose kid's a high major to go somewhere. Like, he was legitimate, really well-known, good coach. Known for offensive flair.
By the way, that's really funny because it just made me think of the Knicks signing Kenny Payne to be an assistant coach, which actually might be that situation where they are trying to sign. It might work.
Free agent season's coming up, and Devin Booker and those guys are excited. But anyway, and Kenny Payne is a fantastic coach too. But that being said, known for offensive flair, you can put him with Devin Booker. You can imagine him coming off high ball screens, kicking to the corner, and Devin Booker, you know, adding years to his career by not having to create on his own. But owner of the Suns, Robert Sarver, he's an Arizona alum. They take Ayton, who averaged 20 and 12. But he didn't play defense, didn't shoot well. Like, you could see he could improve. And I think the Monday morning quarterback is a great call, because there were articles and places where people said, yes, I'd draft Luka first, but everywhere you looked, DeAndre was still number one prospect on all these boards. And then for Sacramento, Vlade Divac knows Doncic's dad, Sasha, for years. He was on the Yugoslavian cadet team while Vlade was on the national team. And you start getting these red flags around draft time. Okay, Luka has a bad diet. He parties too much. He has a bad run of games. He had overuse. Medical reports won't be released. What I'm kind of throwing back to you is it sometimes knowing too much about a prospect a problem, and why was that a miss, versus how much is this truly kind of revisionist history for the number one pick?
So at the time, I did think it was a miss. Phoenix.
So you had, so Luka was number one. You had Luka one?
Yeah, I had Luka at two, and I had DeAndre and Luka at the same, like in the same tier, very clearly a step ahead of everyone else in that draft.
Okay.
So I don't really have a problem with what Phoenix did, to be honest. It's gonna, I mean,
you have,
like,
to, you have to, you have to, like, a little bit though now, right? It's like every game this kid's scoring 39 on one ankle and he's appointment television, just like, what are we doing here?
Yeah, no, like, it was very clearly wrong. But I mean, even back then, I mean, like, I don't really have a problem with the process. I guess the process itself was not great, given some of the reporting. Like, it seems like Ryan McDonough was kind of already on the outs, and James Johnson was like already running the show behind the scenes. And there was like a report, I think from maybe the Arizona Republic or one of the radio stations in Arizona, that did like kind of a deep dive into the process behind why they didn't take Luka. And one of the takeaways was like that Robert Sarver and James Johnson went over to Spain to go see Luka Doncic and like didn't invite McDonough. So like the process was fucked up for Phoenix in general. But I didn't really have a problem at the time taking DeAndre over him. I think that the Sacramento thing was the prime example of overthinking the intel that you have, because Vlade has known the family for as long as he has. He had to have known that Luka is not like a bad kid, but like he must have somehow overvalued like the all of the off-court questions, because the diet was a real question. Like, does he go out a little bit too much? Like, that was a real question at the time. Like, you're not making that up. And that was reported out there at the time as well. I think I wrote about it. Like, I think that he overvalued that aspect of it while simultaneously undervaluing how fucking hard it is to be the best player in goddamn Europe when you're a teenager.
Right.
Like,
he's not turning 22 until February of this next year. Yeah.
He was the best player on an entire fucking continent of basketball players, and good basketball players of all ages who are somewhere between, let's say, 16 and 35, who are just the level below NBA players. He was the best player on that continent, undisputably. Like, it wasn't even close that year. Like, I know that, like, Denny Avdija just won, like, the Israeli National or the Israeli League's Player of the Year. Like, he shouldn't have won that award. Like, Scottie Wilbekin was better than him this year on that same team, right? But that's fine, because Denny is a teenager, and this is a normal progression for a teenager, right? In the case of Luka, this was not, like, an award that was given out for reputational considerations, right? This was given out because he was unquestionably the best player on the goddamn continent. And I think that at the end of the day, what it comes down to is putting the wrong emphases on certain things. Like, whenever you look at a model for DFS, right? Like, you can plug in certain values to certain things. Like, you know, I want 12% of the model to be about, you know, a guy's three-point shooting. I want 22% of the model to be about a guy's finishing at the rim. I want 37% of the model to be about a guy's shot generation and the amount of field goal attempts that he can get from positive areas on the court, right? Like, you can do all of these different inputs and you can adjust the inputs based off of what you're looking for. In the case of the Kings, I would imagine what happened was they put too much of an emphasis on the questionable athleticism and the questionable habits and not enough of an emphasis on this guy was just the best fucking basketball player in Europe, period, full stop.
Yeah, so that was a follow-up I had. Like, based on your intel and being yours as an organization, at what point do you say, like, okay, I get it, I understand, there's some red flags, there's some hangups, but we're taking a dude. And, like, Luke is a dude, and we're taking him here, and we're going to live with it, because what he's able to do and create off the dribble and make everybody around him better, get his own shot, hit step backs, like, at 6'8", that's going to be hard to defend in the NBA. I mean, people still had their hesitations about his athleticism and who he could defend. But yeah, there has to be a certain point where we say he's better than everyone else and we're willing to live with whatever comes with that. And with DeAndre going first, I'm also curious, has the game already changed so much in 2 years that if we redid this without knowing how it ends, does he even go first?
No, right? I think Luka would go first, even if we didn't have the benefit of knowing.
Even if drop coverage didn't exist in the bubble.
Right.
Yeah.
I think that just the value that is now placed on guards, Luka would go first.
Yeah, and it's crazy to kind of look too. I mean, you said it, but the Luka, I like to call it trail of destruction post-draft. So Ryan McDonough was fired, I want to say, before he even played a game. Is that correct?
Maybe a couple games, but it was not.
Okay, so let's just say early. Igor Kokoschkov was fired after a year and then is in this weird purgatory where he becomes assistant coach in Sacramento. So he coaches Ayton and then has to coach Bagley. And then Divac is fired. I mean, when does Atlanta start being worried about how good Luka is? Because two organizations already upside down because of it. Like, is he going to make a third? I mean, this barring injury, and as long as he gets a protector enforcer to prevent getting karate chopped, he's going to have a long, long career. I mean, the kid's 21 years old.
Yeah, I feel like he has a chance to be like a top 10 guy of all time. Like, that's the trajectory we're on right now, is he has a chance to be a top 10 to 15 player of all time. And if you wanted to say it was like more than that, I would understand why that would be your opinion.
Right.
Guy averaged 29, 9, and like 9 this year. It was unbelievable. The guy was absolutely incredible. He's going to finish in the top 6 of MVP voting this year. If you look at LeBron James in his second year, averaged 27, 7, and 7. Obviously, pace was a bit slower then. If I remember correctly, I'm pulling it up now. He finished sixth in MVP voting in 2004, 2005. He finished ninth as a rookie in MVP voting. The next year, he finished second in MVP voting, 2005, 2006. 2007, he finished fifth. 2008, he finished fourth. So, like, you know, in those first 5 years, he was hovering, you know, basically as a top five player in the league, right? And then he took that next great jump into being an MVP, right? Like, as soon as we start to see Luka, who has already made that leap into being like a top five, top six guy in the NBA, in terms of MVP voting, if he can sustain that going forward and then maybe take like another mini leap, it's not going to take much for him to be on that trajectory that LeBron was on, at the very least, when he was this young.
Right. And I think Rick Carlisle had a quote the other night and just said, you know, he needs to get healthy. We got to put the right pieces around him. Obviously, you want Porzingis healthy. It's like, okay, pulling it back to the draft, when you have, I want to say, the 18th pick, are you trying to package that to get someone else? Are you trying to get younger on the wing? Like we kind of talked about before, for maybe like a Vassell type. I mean, where do you kind of think that they move with that?
Oh, I think they would love to get a wing that could play now. I think they're going to have to move up to do it.
Yeah, I do too.
If they want. Yeah. And they do have the 31st overall pick, so like maybe it's plausible that they could. Maybe they could move from 18 to 13 or so. You know, there might be a team within that mix. Like if you're San Antonio, like are you, depending on what they decide to do this summer, could they be looking just to accumulate draft capital? Could Sacramento be like, we're comfortable moving down because, you know, maybe we wanted Isaac Okoro or something and he's not there, so now we can slide back a couple spots. Like, I'll be interested to see what Dallas does, because I agree with you that they just desperately need another wing that can knock down shots.
Yeah, I don't know who the team is either, but I'm guessing there's going to be somebody who wisely tries to get into the 2021 upper tier of that draft too, just based on what's coming down the pipe.
Yeah, I can't imagine that another team is, like, there's no way that a team like the Knicks is going to move that pick. Like, no way that, I don't think Washington can move their pick. I mean, maybe Washington thinks that they're closer than I do. And with John Wall and Brad Beal coming back.
Yeah, the Beal thing matters though too, right? Yeah.
Yeah, and like maybe if it fails, like you can move Brad Beal and get that pick back, right? Yeah, I'd be pretty stunned though if they decided to go down that route. Like Orlando, what Orlando does this year is going to be really fascinating to me, if only because they don't have John Isaac next year, and they're incredibly well coached and very professional and very smart in terms of the way that they prepare their guys to play. But man, that team is under talented in such a substantial way.
Right.
So yeah, it's going to be tough. I don't know. Is there anything else you want to talk about, or are we going to call it there, Matt?
Yeah, I mean, we can probably call it there, knowing that we've covered our fill of bubble and draft, scratch that itch for the day. And I know at some point we'll get into the weeds for 2021 guys, but we have many moons to go before we get there.
Yeah, we have 2021 guys. We still have 2020 guys. Like, we should do a deep dive on Alexei Pokyashevsky at some point, because that guy is just fascinating in so many ways. We should do a like real deep dive on some of these guards, like Grant Riller and Tyrell Terry and Cassius Winston and Peyton Pritchard and some of these like later first round, early second round guys. I don't know that we should talk about Malachi Flynn anymore, because
you're Malachi, not allowed to. I think
yeah, Malachi might be getting
against you. Yeah,
yeah, might be getting a little bit concerned, I think.
Yeah,
about the amount of love I've shown him. So Matt, tell the people where they can find you on the internet.
I'm on Twitter. You can find me. I have to tweet a lot more. I have like self-conscious stuff about like, do people care that I think that Superbad is really rewatchable? But Twitter, it's MPENN1E. Yeah, that's where I'm at.
Matt's great. Superbad is very rewatchable, by the way.
You can't go past it if it's on cable television. There's nothing on TV.
Yeah, and like the Ringer folks have built an entire podcast about rewatchable movies. So you're fine. Keep tweeting about that. I tweeted about Lovecraft Country last night. Like,
and Can't Hardly Wait. So we're in the same stratosphere, I guess.
That's right. Can't Hardly Wait is
fantastic. Still holds up.
It still holds up in every conceivable capacity.
Dating myself, but yeah.
No. You're not dating yourself. We're still in our 30s. We're fine.
It's true.
I'm Sam Vecini. This has been the Game Theory Podcast. I just wrote a big breakdown on the Minnesota Timberwolves. Go read that. I will have a mini mock draft update at some point later this week, as well as updated draft rankings at some point this week. It's actually a pretty big week for us over at The Athletic in terms of what I'm publishing. So go there, subscribe, look at all that stuff. We'll be back later this week, probably talking more about NBA basketball in the bubble, as opposed to kind of utilizing it to form draft opinions like we did today with Matt Penny. But until next time, we'll talk soon. Bye.